regularly during the first months of the pandemic because of food scarcity caused by panic buying and supply problems, the latest increase is put down to rising cost of living and to poverty. Food banks are reporting that energy costs are so prohibitive for some people, they request that charity food parcels that contain no food that has to be cooked using a cooker or that needs to be stored in a fridge or freezer. The rapid deterioration in food security reflects soaring energy, food and petrol prices, coupled with below inflation benefit rises. The Food Foundation said it was so shocked by its initial findings that it re-ran the survey on a wider basis, only to get the same results. It predicted food insecurity figures were likely to get worse over the next few months as inflation continues to rise and the full impact of April's national insurance rise hits family budgets along with the lifting of the energy price cap. Anna Taylor, the Food Foundation's executive director, said, "The extremely rapid rise in food insecurity since January points to a catastrophic situation for British families. Food insecurity puts families under extreme mental stress and forces people to survive on the cheapest calories, which lead to health problems." Professor Sir Michael Marmot, a public health expert at University College London, says, "If one household in seven is food insecure, society is failing in a fundamental way." These figures on food insecurity are all the more chilling because the problem is soluble. But far from being solved, it is actually getting worse. There is little expectation that ministers will raise benefits or expand free school meals anytime soon, despite rising public concern over the cost of living. Last week, George Eustace, the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Secretary, urged consumers to switch to value brands to save on grocery spending in response to rising food prices. Bless him, George Eustace is actually aware there are cheaper brand foods in the world. The poor man who has lived such a sheltered life, he thought 10 pence off a tin of beans would solve the problem, said Kathleen Kerridge, an office manager and food activist from Portsmouth. On the food poverty frontline, charities are warning that demand for food is rising as budgets get tighter. Ellen Scarlett Ryan of Bassett Law Food Bank in Worksop said it supplied 24 households with food parcels on the day after Easter last month, way ahead of its previous record of 16. Many of these clients had never before used food banks and were struggling with their newfound reliance on charity to feed their families. Ellen Scarlett Ryan said, "We are finding people in floods of tears. They are so scared that they're at their wits' end. It is such a difficult and emotional time for them." Households were making the food go further, she said, putting smaller portions on the table and bulking out dishes with lentils and rice. A growing number were asking for food that did not require cooking with the gas on, as they could not afford to push cash in the meter. On Monday, Keith Anderson, the chief executive of Scottish Power, said a fresh support package would be vital before a further dramatic increase in the cost of gas and electricity bills due this October. A government spokesperson said, "We recognise the pressures on the cost of living and we're doing what we can to help, including spending £22 billion across the next financial year to support people with energy bills and cut fuel duty. For the hardest hit, we're putting an average of £1,000 more per year into the pockets of working families on universal credit. Have also boosted the minimum wage for more than £1,000 a year for full-time workers, and our household support fund is there to help with the cost of everyday essentials."
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. A celebrity anti-Semitism campaigner was recently forced to admit that she'd made false allegations of anti-Semitism against a supporter of Palestinian rights. British actress Tracey Ann Oberon has issued an apology and paid undisclosed damages to her victim. To shield herself from criticism, Oberon pointed to her work with the charity Children of Peace, which works with young people in Gaza and the West Bank. But what is Children of Peace? In today's programme, we'll examine how a small British charity serves as a front group for Zionist interests. Later in the show, we'll look at the case of Tracey Ann Oberon and her involvement in smearing supporters of Palestinian rights and her association with pro-Israel lobby groups like Children of Peace. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi.
Children of Peace. What could be more innocent an organisation set up to encourage young Israeli and Palestinian people to understand each other better? It operates directly in Gaza, the world's largest open-air prison, so one might think it was a critic of the Zionist entity. But when Palestine Declassified looked a little more closely, we discovered a strong Zionist bias in its activities. Children of Peace says it simply refuses to take sides on Palestine, a clear euphemism for siding with the oppressor, the occupying power. Among the trustees are Sarah Ans Brown, a former regular contributor to the Islamophobic attack blog Harry's Place. The charity receives pro bono legal advice from the law firm Taylor Wessing, which also participates on its advisory board. Taylor Wessing, which has a strong Israel group, is co-led by Nathan Krapovitsky, who is also a volunteer for the Australian Zionist group, the United Israel Appeal. Amongst its partners, the organisation lists the Abraham Fund Initiatives, an Israeli government-funded lobby entity, and One Voice, and its subsidiary Solutions, Not Sides, which is grooming schoolchildren to be pro-Israel. Both organisations have strong links with Israeli intelligence and the military. The charity recruits friends, amongst which are many Zionists, who do not struggle to take sides on Palestine. Rolene Marks, a participant in the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs Young Jewish Diplomats Leadership Course and a former representative to the World Zionist Congress. She is also co-founder of the South Africa-Israel Policy Forum, an Israel lobby group. Dumisani Washington, who joined in March this year, is described by Children of Peace as one of the greatest advocates for Israel. He is a leading member of Christians United for Israel. Tracey Ann Oberon, the actress and campaigner against alleged anti-Semitism, also joined as a friend in March. Perhaps most concerning is the apparent role of covert lobby groups for the United Arab Emirates in the operation. Amongst the partners of the charity is the impressive-sounding Global Imams Council, which was welcomed as a partner in 2021. Based in Najaf, Iraq, this group has recently shown signs of penetration by the lobby of the United Arab Emirates. For example, the election of the so-called Imam of Peace, Mohammad Tawhidi, in early 2022. Tawhidi was also named by Children of Peace as a friend of the charity in March 2022. Tawhidi is well known to be an asset of the foreign policy establishment of the Emiratis and the go-to imam for elements of the UK far right, such as the Islamophobe Tommy Robinson. Other UAE assets that support Children of Peace are Muslims Against Anti-Semitism. One of its leaders, Fiaz Mughal, is a friend of the charity. Children of Peace is a sophisticated subversion strategy involving a variety of lobby groups based in Iraq, occupied Palestine, the United Arab Emirates, and the UK.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined by British political activist and writer, Jackie Walker. Jackie was born in Harlem in New York City. She's been a teacher and an anti-racist trainer. She's the co-writer and performer of a one-woman show, The Lynching, which documents how she became an early high-profile victim of the Labour Party's anti-Semitism witch hunt. And Jackie joins us from Ramsgate in Kent. Welcome to the show. David, I wonder if I could start with you. I mean, the Children of Peace sounds fairly harmless, doesn't it, really, on the face of it? I mean, how is it detrimental, do you think, to the Palestinian struggle?
Well, this is one of a whole range of organisations which we've looked at in many of the editions of this programme, which appears to be harmless, which appears to be encouraging nice things like peace and reconciliation and understanding, but which are covert vehicles for Zionists. So it engages in projects in Gaza, in the West Bank, even in 48 Palestine, which try and get children to be friends with each other in order that they can stop discussing the really controversial issues about the fact of the occupation. And that's the purpose of this, is to divert attention from the occupation, to pretend that people who support Israel are interested in peace and reconciliation, and to give cover for those who it attracts to be their representatives. Hmm.
Jackie, in your experience as an anti-racist trainer, I mean, do you think that this organisation's an effective way to combat structural racism?
No, I mean, obviously not. I mean, that's not how you do it. You actually have a balance, if you're going to have a balance, although I don't know what balance means in this circumstance, because we know the Israeli position as an occupying power and as an apartheid state. So I'm not quite sure what balance means in this point. So, I mean, I just think it's vacuous.
Mm. David, I mean, there's this UAA-backed initiative that was mentioned in the report. What's the significance of that?
Well, since the Arab Spring, the United Arab Emirates has become one of the foremost pushers of Islamophobia around the world, including in the UK and the US and in other countries too. And it's interesting that they are involved in this organisation seemingly too. They practice a kind of collaboration with Zionist lobbyists, and you can see that very much in the balance of friends and supporters that are here. That it's an attempt to push Islamophobic ideas and to push the idea that all that we need in Israel and Palestine is a bit of understanding. We don't actually need justice, and that's the key message that they're pushing. But the UAE lobby has a number of different ways of expressing itself through groups in the UK, for example, which, and in the case of this film in Iraq, where it's not clear that these are UAE lobby groups, and one has to delve a little bit deep to find out. And that's what we did in this programme, to have a little look at that and to see the way in which UAE foreign policy interests are sort of filtered out through organisations like this.
Could you say us a little bit about this character, Imam Tawhidi? What's his story?
Well, Imam Tawhidi is a really very interesting character. Shia cleric. In his early interventions in the public sphere, he promoted a virulently anti-Sunni sectarianism, and then he kind of toned that down a little bit and realised that the gravy train that he wanted to get onto was the Western Islamophobic gravy train. So he now consorts with the far right and the Islamophobic network across the whole of the world, in Australia, in the UK, in the US. He hangs out with Tommy Robinson in the UK and Anne-Marie Waters, another far-right Islamophobe, and in the States with Spencer and with Daniel Pipes of the Islamophobic Middle East Forum. So he hangs out with those people. But he also is involved strongly with the United Arab Emirates so-called Peace Forum, which is part of a normalisation strategy to pretend that Zionism is something which could be a reasonable interlocutor for debate and discussion and moving towards peace, which, of course, it's not.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, there's all sorts of celebrities associated with this organisation, Children of Peace, that are also involved in the anti-Semitism witch hunt. I mean, you know, noted comedians like David Baddiel and Matt Lucas apparently are listed on their site. I mean, what's the role, do you think, of these celebrities in laundering the image of Israel?
Yeah, well, there's a number of them. I mean, most of them are pretty B, what we would call B players, really. You've got Eddie Marsden, you've got Rachel Riley. And what they do is that they sort of they kind of wash, don't they? They give cover to these murderous organisations. And what's extraordinary about them, because they've got quite a wide reach, both because of who follows them and of their general TV exposure, is that people come to them and they think, these look like nice people, they're interesting people. They must be right about what they're saying. And if you in particular look at David Baddiel, who's just written this nonsensical book about discrimination, prejudice, racism against Jews, what never happens to these people is that they're never actually challenged. And it's not for want of trying. I know people who have tried to get on the British media to challenge their arguments. They never get on. And here we are, we're supposedly living in a free speech society.
I mean, Jackie, we talked about these various celebrities, but also listed was the Palestinian envoy to the UK. I mean, what do you think that says about the Palestinian Authority?
Well, we understand the compromised position of the Palestinian Authority. And all of this, it all looks like one particular picture, doesn't it, of being able to get these proxy players to kind of associate and authenticate what is a brutal and barbaric vestige of colonialism.
Yeah, I mean, and David, what if you could say something about the Proudfoot case?
Well, I mean, one of the things about that is that Tracy Ann Oberman accused Philip Proudfoot of operating a Jew block list, i.e. blocking Jews on Twitter, which was, of course, a fabrication entirely false, and she had to apologise for that. And what I think is most interesting about that is the way in which she subsequently used as a shield to defend herself her involvement with a number of pro-Israel organisations. Now, her general line is that she's just there to combat anti-Semitism, and she's not there as a Zionist, she's not there as a paid-up Israel lobbyist, but the organisations which she's used to defend herself, Solutions Not Sides, Children of Peace, are organisations which are deeply involved in Zionist advocacy. So what this case shows, inadvertently in relation to Tracy Ann Oberman, I think, is the way in which they are directly involved in pro-Israel and pro-Zionist advocacy. And of course, as we would have always suspected, the anti-Semitism activism in which they are engaged is part of that programme.
Yeah. And of course, Philip Proudfoot is a founder of the Northern Independence Party. But we'll just leave it there now, because we've got a report about Tracy Ann Oberman, who is an enthusiastic participant in the anti-Semitism witch hunt in the UK.
The actress and E-list celebrity Tracy Ann Oberman has spent many years on British television screens, from the trashy soap EastEnders to other nondescript roles in forgettable TV programmes. She's failed to make much of a mark in the acting world. Recently, she's taken to the road performing the controversial role of Shylock in the Shakespeare play Merchant of Venice. Some have claimed that the Shylock character perpetuates stereotypes, Judaphobic stereotypes, but that doesn't seem to bother Oberman, who, like other E-listers, have made a name for themselves by falsely accusing others of anti-Semitism. The hypocritical wannabe Oberman has implied that almost everyone, from Amnesty International to Equity, the Union for Actors, Singers, Models and General Creatives, are motivated by anti-Semitism. The crime of her targets has always been connected to their support for the Palestinian cause. She has openly coordinated with Israel lobby groups like the Board of Deputies and groups with significant links to Israeli intelligence like the Community Security Trust. Here she is smearing the Actors Union Equity as racist for supporting a demonstration for Palestinian rights.
The problem that Jewish actors are having, and I think Maureen felt the same way, is that by dint of Equity's leadership statement, it's sort of turning into a political loyalty test for Jews in our industry.
But in a wonderful twist of fate, our insufferable protagonist and de facto leader got her comeuppance. On April 4th, 2021, she falsely claimed that Palestinian rights activist Dr. Philip Proudfoot had a Jew block list on the Twitter website. This was, of course, completely false. Almost a year later, she's been forced to issue a public apology and reach a financial settlement with Dr. Proudfoot for her false claim of anti-Semitism. However, the incident has exposed connections between Oberman and organizations which have been revealed to have extensive links with Israeli intelligence. She has regularly advocated for the anti-BDS, Behavioral Change Organization, Solutions Not Sides, which targets Muslim children in British school. As a project of One Voice, Solutions Not Sides shared funders with the Friends of the IOF, illegal settler colonies in the West Bank, and the Conservative Party. Perhaps worse than that, the organization has had at least 3 employees simultaneously working for the Israeli government and at least 28 former Israeli occupation forces or intelligence service members working within it. This should place major question marks on our E-list celebrity and her activities in the public sphere.
Jackie, I wonder if I could come to you now. I mean, you've been involved in the arts and theatre now for many years. I just wonder what your take is on the entertainment industry.
Well, I think that my take on the entertainment industry is exactly my take on pretty much everything else. I mean, it's just a joke for Tracy Ann Oberman to be complaining about the exposure that people like her get, because as far as I'm concerned, it's far too much. Because they get an exposure without any challenge to their views. And, you know, this idea that they are being challenged, and, you know, all we've got to think of is what happens to pro-Palestinian people who work in the media. I mean, we recently saw 2 actresses who had terrible, terrible pylons on them, the saying just basically, remember Palestine. I mean, this is extraordinary, but it shows the imbalance that's going on. And as long as we have this one-sided media, this is what we'll get. But the interesting thing about this, I think, is the media is actually failing to keep control of the narrative. Because if you talk to most people, they know it's untrue. So these people, they have sway with the elite. They have sway with the right, but most other people know exactly what's going on.
David, what do you think the significance is of Oberman advocating so strongly for Solutions Not Sides?
Well, it drives the coach and horses through the idea that there is any serious campaign against anti-Semitism in this country, which is divorced from a campaign for the State of Israel. And this Solutions Not Sides organization is, of course, part of another organization called One Voice, both of which are friends and associates of Children of Peace. And as the film showed there, I mean, they had people working within the organization who were at the same time working in Israeli intelligence or working in the Israeli embassy. Now, that's an extraordinary position to be in. And an organization like that should have no place in British political life. And yet someone like Oberman is advocating for it, which really reveals that the actual political agenda that is in operation here and is all of a piece with the activities of Children of Peace itself.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, what would you say to people who say, well, these celebrities are just concerned about racism, not an issue about their sort of, you know, advocating for Israel, it's just a concern about racism. I mean, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think all you have to do is do a bit of digging to see how untrue that is. There's a blog called Zelo Street, which actually has a list of the racism behind a number of these celebrities. So, for example, you have David Baddiel, who's well known in terms of having blacked up and made fun of a black football player to the point where I think this guy almost committed suicide and was being beaten up in the street. And he's never, as far as I've been told, directly said sorry to this person about it. I mean, what all of these celebrities share in common is a very strong sense of a hierarchy of racism that, interestingly enough, puts them on the top.
Yeah, I mean, and I know that you've been a target of abuse by some of these celebrities. I mean, tell us a little about the kind of human toll, the human cost of actually being a target like that by these high-profile individuals.
So there's types of human costs, and I'm sure David and you know what I'm talking about, for goodness sake. It goes right from the fact that, you know, at one time I was, you know, well published writer. I'll never get a book published again. I can hardly get a performance done anywhere. So there's that sort of the end of your political career. And that's just what it means, the end of your artistic career. That is what it means if you speak out. But there's also, you know, the personal cost, because I'm Jewish. I'm married to somebody who's Jewish. His family live in Israel, Palestine. And the fallout on that for our family has been extraordinary. And there were times when I was getting threats. I was going to be burnt. I was going to be raped. I was going to be hung outside my door. My children were going to be abused in the same way. And I was receiving those kind of threats repeatedly. Interestingly, the media or the Labour Party were not at all interested in the level of threats that I was getting. And I'm sure that's a familiar story for many people in my position.
David, I mean, what's the relationship between this Solutions Not Sides and One Voice?
Well, Solutions Not Sides is an organisation which the Education Secretary, last year when the attack on Gaza was happening, wrote to all head teachers and said, you mustn't be having unbalanced narratives about Israel-Palestine in the classroom. You must instead have three organisations who give balanced narratives, and Solutions Not Sides was one of those organisations. And as it turns out, Solutions Not Sides is not really an independent organisation. It's part of another organisation called One Voice, which is itself closely connected to the Israeli intelligence apparatus, but also to the Israeli military. Something like 20 or 30 former members of staff, certain members of staff there have formerly been in the Israel Defense Forces, including in special forces. And so there's a very strong connection between Solutions Not Sides and One Voice, and that they themselves have a strong connection with the Israeli establishment. So there's a real issue here, which is that the British government is promoting effectively Zionist propaganda in British schools as an antidote to Muslims feeling solidarity with Palestine. And that kind of thing should just be stopped.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, you know, you've spoken about, you know, the abuse and the toll that it's taken on you and indeed, you know, others. But I remember, I mean, it took an even more sinister turn, didn't it, a couple of 3 years ago when there was going to be a screening. I mean, I was up in, I think it was in Liverpool, actually, for the Labour Party conference. There's going to be a screening of the film Witch Hunt, which documents in large detail the travails that you've been subjected to. I mean, obviously, that was a very kind of worrying threat. I wonder if you could just sort of say whether you feel that the role of these celebrities have actually, you know, put you in danger, effectively.
Well, I just want to say something about what happened there, because it was extraordinary, because this screening was actually sponsored by a Jewish group. So there were lots of Jews there. And somebody phoned up and said something like, there's a bomb there, we're going to kill a lot of Jews. There were police cars and everything. Everybody had to leave the theatre. There was not one national report of that happening during the Labour Party conference, not one. There was a local paper report, and that tells you a lot of what actually is happening in terms of this. So what we do with that, we just go on, don't we? We just continue to write and speak and fight against it, just like you do, Chris, and just like David does.
That's what we have to do. We have to stand tall and keep going. Thank you very much indeed, Jackie, for joining us. And thank you for your courage. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, because we've unfortunately run out of time. But thanks indeed for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Dumped at sea, lost on land or left to rot in shops and fridges, the global catch of fish is being wasted like never before, hurting not only the oceans but the nutrition of billions of people. But can it be reversed? We present you an article written by Emma Bryce. The piece is titled Millions of Tons of Dead Animals, The Growing Scandal of Fish Waste. In February of 2022, a Dutch-owned fishing trawler released a silvery stream of 100,000 dead fish, which carpeted several thousand square meters of ocean off the coast of France. The vessel's owners blamed the discharge on a faulty net. Environmental groups charged that the fish were intentionally dumped. Whatever the truth, that spectacle of squandered sea life was the tip of the iceberg. Figures from the World Wildlife Fund, the WWF, show that in 2019, at least 230,000 tons of fish were dumped in European Union waters. Most of the waste, or 92% of it, is related to bottom trawling, a fishing method that scrapes the sea floor, indiscriminately scooping up everything in its path. But this figure is a small fraction of an even larger global issue. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, estimates that 35% of all fish, crustaceans and mollusks harvested from oceans, lakes and fish farms are wasted or lost before they ever reach a plate. Fish are highly perishable and fragile, which makes them more vulnerable to waste, a problem that is compounded by hemorrhaging fish at every step of the supply chain. Pete Pearson, Senior Director for Food Waste at the World Wildlife Fund, says, "Fish waste is especially shocking because they are wild animals, so we are harvesting wildlife. Fish populations are already threatened by overfishing, pollution, and the climate crisis. With current rates of fish consumption projected to double by 2050, waste is increasingly on the radar of regulators." Omar Pinyaruba, a fishery officer at the Food and Agricultural Organization, says, We have to do something about it. Experts say that begins with understanding exactly what is driving waste between harvest and plate. The task is made difficult by fisheries' notoriously opaque supply chains and incomplete data sets that are also inconsistent, although the evidence is clear that most fish waste starts at the point of extraction. Just under half of all fish consumed by people is wild, caught at sea. Pete Pearson says, "There's such an abundance that we've grown to be okay with certain loss rates, although noting that 34% of global marine stocks are now overfished. Bycatch, unintentionally caught unwanted fish, is a growing problem. Roughly 10% of wild caught fish are discarded worldwide each year, representing 8.6 million tons of animals. The main culprits are imprecise fishing gear and policies that allow fishers to discard non-target species. There's an economic driver too. Rashid Samela, professor of ocean and fisheries economics at the University of British Columbia in Canada, says, I think there is a strong connection between subsidies and waste in the water. Although subsidies were historically devised to support small-scale fishers, Professor Samela's research shows today 80% of $35.4 billion in annual fishing subsidies goes to a handful of industrial fleets. These include gargantuan bottom trawlers that are uniquely equipped to travel out to the high seas and overfish, leading to discards on an industrial scale. Professor Samela says the impact of illegal and unreported fishing is also important, as it is likely contributing tons more bycatch to global fish waste. Fish waste is about more than just the physical loss of fish. For the 3 billion people whose diets depend on fish, it is a lost nutritional opportunity. Shakuntala Tilstead, global lead for nutrition and public health at World Fish and winner of the 2021 World Food Prize, says, the narrative is that we have to produce more to feed the growing masses, but the greatest pathway to increasing supply is reducing loss and waste. Many sea-controlled aquaculture systems or fish farms, which generate more than half of our fish supply, as a solution to the waste of wild fishing. But Dave Love, senior scientist at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, says that various factors such as disease are driving considerable losses on fish farms too. Dave Love says mortality in fish ponds is actually a significant source of lost potential food. Fish waste continues after harvest, though how it unfolds differs depending on location. Omar Pinarubia says the Food and Agricultural Organization estimates that 27% of all fish globally is lost or wasted after landing, but in low-income countries, the fish is more likely to be unintentionally lost than wasted. One study showed that in Ghana, in Burkina Faso and Togo, 65% of lost fish on land was attributable to poor handling, lack of storage facilities and cooling facilities on fishing vessels, and along the lengthy supply chain. Fish disappear after distribution too, but here the culprits are retailers and consumers, almost exclusively in middle and high-income countries. In North America, Oceania and Europe, fish waste at consumption far outstrips that of any other region in the world. Pete Pearson thinks retailers in the United States partly contribute to the problem by prioritizing large fresh fish to sell at a premium, which quickly spoil. He says, this is the real tragedy because it's moved all the way through the supply chain and then we're comfortable with a 10% to 30% loss rate in the grocery store. Dave Love published a research showing that retailers were responsible for about 16% of wasted seafood in the United States, while up to 63% comes down to consumers putting uneaten fish in the bin. He says when retailers prioritize fresh fish, the ripple effect is that consumers are more likely to waste that in their homes. Solutions do exist to reduce fish spoilage along the supply chain. Increasing access to cold chain technologies in low-income countries, along with methods such as solar-powered drying tents, could extend the shelf life of fish. Omar Pinarubia says fishers and processors also need training on better fish handling and storage to limit loss. Pete Pearson and Dave Love argue that at the consumer end, we should encourage more people to opt for frozen fish, which could reduce demand for fresh fish in grocery stores and limit the amount that is lost in retail and people's homes. Tilstead suggests diversifying our appetites beyond the ubiquitous fish fillet to smaller fish and bivalves, which can be consumed whole to reduce waste. She says, if our notion of fish is a fillet on a pan, then we are already far down the path of loss and waste because we have reduced the edible part to such a small portion of the whole. Existing fish byproducts can be captured and turned into new ones. Fish heads, fish fins and bones from the fishing industry are already a source of fertilizer and feed. Now innovators are finding uses for everything from fish skin, for burn treatments, and crustacean waste to make biodegradable packaging. However, Pete Pearson, who cautions that we shouldn't overstate these solutions, says, the idea of full utilization is something that needs to be pervasive across all food supply chains. Unless fish byproducts replace a share of fish demand, they are simply making use of waste, not reducing it at source. Ultimately, Pete Pearson says, prevention is the best solution, starting at sea, where this problem begins. Fishers need to be equipped with more selective gear for fishing and aided by policies that discourage discards. Professor Samela underscores the need for good subsidies that can be channeled towards fisheries that help replenish wild stocks. He says, we need to spend taxpayer money in ways that reinforce positive feedback from people to nature and from nature to people. Pete Pearson says, for generations we've believed the ocean is huge and we can just take whatever we want from the ocean. Now we're coming to see the limits of that, and when you have limits, it requires you to become more efficient.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the U.S. economy destroyed U.S. production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis
because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us. And we welcome you to the club now. So if you could please explain for our audience in as much detail as possible, what is the current global financial situation dominated by the West that is now coming to an end? Some of the main features of it, some of those main issues as to this current situation, and how is it that we are now transitioning away from this current system and into a new system?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I shall try to explain the current situation from the viewpoint of the theory of long-term economic development. I am an expert in this long-term cycles theory, and the present situation is a situation of transition. The world is changing dramatically. It changes both technologically and institutionally. This time, we are going through two transitions. The first transition is technological revolution, the transition to the new technological mode, which means that the economy is suffering from the drastic changes in the technological structure. Each technological structure is the basis for the so-called Kondratiev long wave.
Yes.
These cycles have 50 years length, and every 50 years we have approximately we have technological revolution. This period is a period of depression in the economy, because the companies, especially in the developed countries, are suffering from the excess of capital in the obsolete industries. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to transfer capital from the obsolete industries to the new one. This transition started about 15 years ago, and now it is coming to the end. The new technological mode, which is based on nanotechnologies, information technologies, digital technologies, biotechnologies, bioengineering technologies, and now is formed, and its expansion is going on the with the accelerated growth. The growth rate of this new technologies is about 35% per year. At the same time, we are going through the institutional change. This changes are taking place in with much more longer periods. The Italian scholar and banker Arrighi studied the so-called long-term cycles, or he called this century cycles, systemic cycles of capital accumulations. And each such cycle is based on the specific institutional structure. For instance, during the last two centuries, we have seen the changes from the colonial type of economy, which was based on the huge world powers in Europe, British Empire, colonial empire, French Empire, Russian Empire, and so forth. Those colonial period of capital accumulation is more or less good explanations given by Marx. He showed in his papers that the main feature of this kind of economic structure is antagonistic conflict between labor and capital. This colonial period was characterized by the slave trade, by the exploitation of all over the world by the European empires, and there were no any social rights, no trade unions, nothing which could protect workers from the exploitations from the capitalists. This colonial type structure collapsed in the beginning of the 20th century. The First World War and the Second World War were provoked by the British in order to maintain the British Empire as a leader of the world. The point is that this transition period from one cycle to the another cycle usually is going on through the world wars, because the ruling elite of the leading countries do not want any changes. And at that time, 100 years ago, we have seen two world wars. Both were provoked and organized by British, and the Second World War also by the Americans, who made a huge investments in militarization on German Empire. And the idea of these two wars designed by the British was to have a conflict between Russia and Germany in order to prevent their development. At the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russian Empire together were in very close relations. And they produced more goods and they were more advanced. They had faster growth rates than British Empire. And it was quite clear that Russian and German Empire, together with Austrian Empire and Ottoman Empire, becomes a new center of the world. In order to prevent this formation of the new center of the world, British provoked the First World War, which destroyed all those empires, and Europe was also destroyed, and British maintained their world leadership till the Second World War. But at the same time, we have seen the Russian Socialist Revolution and the emergency of the principally new institutional structure. It was a structure based on the central planning economy, which was very new, and which demonstrated a huge growth rates. The industrialization and growth rates of not only of industrial production, but of the whole economy in the Soviet Russia was the highest in the world at that time. At the same time, in the United States, another type of this new institutional structure also emerged, based on the transnational corporations. From the organizational point of view, the Soviet system and the American system were rather similar. The basic unit in the organizational structure was large corporation. In the Soviet Union, it was called ministries, which organized production in this or that industries. In the Western world, they were transnational corporations. For the first time in the history, the governments invented the fiat money which we used in endless scale. Mm-hmm. The government, the central banks, government central banks, started to print money in those quantities which were necessary to finance investments for economic development. For the first time, we have seen that the monetary limits were overcome. There are no any problems for the finance industrialization in the Soviet Union because the state bank printed as much money as were necessary to finance the growth of productions and investments. The only limits were physical resources. At the same time, in the United States, the Federal Reserve emerged, and Federal Reserves also started to print money in those quantities which were necessary for the American government to finance its budget and to stimulate economic growth. These two principally new, but politically opposite systems, they were common in the way of organization of production, but they were opposite in the political sense. In America, we have seen democracy, in Russia, communist totalitarian state. In spite of the political antagonism, those two systems demonstrated very fast growth, especially the Soviet systems, which didn't suffer from the Great Depression. The Great Britain started to lose its hegemony again. And again, they started to provoke the New World War, again, between Russia, between Soviet Union and Germany. Finally, the war finished with the political results, which was very astonishing for the British, because the British lost the empire, in spite of the fact that they were among the winners. They lost empire because the two superpowers emerged, the Soviet Union and United States, which were much more efficient than the British colonial type state.
That's right.
These large scale corporations and ministries organized production, mass production, in much more efficient way than have been done by the private companies in the British Empire. So British Empire collapsed the so-called imperial, as we define it, imperial world order began, dominated by the two superpowers. Now this cycle comes to the end. Mm-hmm. First, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union about 30 years ago.
Yes.
Now we are looking for the collapse of the United States. The Soviet Union collapsed because the central planning economy was very rigid, and it didn't satisfy for the needs of the science and technological progress. This was very a bureaucratic system which reject innovations. And finally, the Soviet Union began to go in, down in technological competition. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the only one leader. But this leadership was not forever, because the American system today is based on the creation of the fiat capital, which has no limits. You see, according to the Arrighi studies, mm-hmm. each one-century cycle of the accumulation of capital has two phases. The first phase is material expansion. The new system of management, the new, more efficient institutions give opportunity for those countries which use these institutions to become the leaders in the industrial production, in the real sector. But after two generations, the leadership in industrial sector transfers to the leadership in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And the second half of this century is the financial expansions. Financial expansion of American capital now have such a scale that the efficiency in the rail sector simply does